The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we
because
have
they are hard.
Start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, listeners, and welcome to our Sunday Space Show program. I'm your host, David Livingston. Thank you very much for tuning in. Very interesting scientific medical program planned for you today. We are using the 60-minute format. So, again, watch your clock. And if you do have a phone call to get into our guest, who I will introduce in just a minute, or an email, please make sure you do it while we're still on the air, because, again, we're following the 60-minute format for today. So our toll-free number, for those of you who would like to use it, and remember that is the preferred way of communicating with our guest, it is 1-866-687-7223. There are no call screeners, so be patient. Wait, I'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. You will hear the program live through your telephone when you call us, so please kill your computer speakers. So you can either silence them or just kill the internet feed. But if you try to keep the feed from the computer going with what you hear on the telephone, you'll be totally confused because they're not in sync. There's all sorts of delays built in to the signal and for safety, and they're not even close to being in sync with one another. Sometimes they're as much as 2 minutes off. So please kill your computer speaker feed while you're waiting on the telephone. You'll hear everything live on the telephone. And you can email us at drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. You can also post comments on our blog, which means you go to our website, thespaceshow.com. All the way to the far right is the upcoming show menu. This is the first program listed. Open it up, and down at the bottom is where you make comments, ask questions. As soon as you do that, I'll get a copy and can integrate it into our discussion. And please do remember, you do not have to be logged into a Discuss account to post a comment on the blog. That is our blog commentary program, but you can do so as a guest. So any of those three ways work, but the toll-free phone is our preferred way of communicating with our guest. Do visit our website newsletter on the Space Show homepage, spaceshow.com. It will be uploaded after today's program, and it will have all the programs in detail for next week. Plus, if you scroll down, you'll see all the programs we have planned between now and the end of second quarter 2019. Do remember, everything we do is archived. You can listen right off of our website or quickly download shows. There is a store for those of you interested in Space Show logo wear. The quickest way to access that is you'll see a picture of Pepper, my Siberian Husky, listening to the Space Show on every single right side of the Space Show website pages. Click on that. It takes you to our Cafe Press store. And for those of you actually interested in Pepper swag, just scroll down to the bottom of that. But we have all sorts of categories of items listed with Space Show logo wear. So hopefully you'll find some items of interest. Also in the upper left menu is a Listen Live button. So this tells you and everyone else how to listen to live shows, MP3 archives off of our website, and podcasts, including those of you who are using Alexa and the TuneIn player. If you have any questions, don't hesitate to email me, drspace@thespaceshow.com, and please feel free to share all of that information as well. Also on our homepage, very, very important, please remember that we are a listener-supported nonprofit program, and without your financial contributions, we would not be doing the show and bringing you great guests like the one we have today, who I will introduce in just a minute. As a 501c3, if you are paying federal U.S. taxes, you do get a tax deduction. And if you're paying California taxes, you also get a tax deduction. Our parent is onegiantleapfoundation.org. Check it out. And if you have any questions about our nonprofit or what we're doing, don't hesitate to email me again, drspace@thespaceshow.com. In the center right of our homepage, you'll see supporting the Space Show. That tells you how to support us via PayPal or sending in checks for those of you who do not like to use electronic means. You'll also see a big Amazon button. Amazon has two great programs for nonprofits. We're registered with both of them. And if you're an habitual Amazon shopper, as I am, you can buy just about everything through the One Giant Leap portal or their Smile site. With One Giant Leap is the approved nonprofit, and Amazon donates a portion of the purchase price to the Space Show. So it's a great way to support the Space Show by just doing what you always do if you're a shopper with Amazon.com. And in addition to all of that, we do have sponsorships. So we change their banner ads going across the homepage whenever the sponsor wants. On regular length 90-minute programs, we read a quick sponsor message. But on the shorter formatted programs like today, I just mentioned who our sponsors are. We're very, very grateful and appreciative to them. Without their sponsorships, we probably wouldn't be doing the show either. So we do thank Northrop Grumman, the Space Foundation, Moonwords, AIAA, the Space Development Network, and you can reach them at developspaceinfo. And then also Celestis, the National Space Society, and the Space Plan through the Integrated Space Plan. And again, we're very, very appreciative of our sponsors. I'm very happy for welcoming a new guest to the Space Show who's not been with us before. Dr. Rachel Seidler is with us. She is a professor in the Department of Applied Physiology and Kinesiology at the University of Florida. Her research focuses on the neural control movement in health and disease with a specific focus on motor learning. She uses a range of neuroimaging and neuromodulation techniques coupled with precise measures of movement and cognitive function to determine the neurocognitive underpinnings of motor control. She has expertise working in a variety of populations, including healthy young and older adults, Parkinson's disease patients, and, here's the connection to the Space Show, NASA astronauts in both basic science and intervention experiments. Her work has been supported by the NIH, NSF, NASA, and the National Space Biomedical Research Institute, along with many different private foundations. Active work in her lab includes investigation of human brain plasticity with spaceflight and experiments investigating which cognitive processes support skill acquisition and how they map onto underlying neural pathways. I saw a paper of hers that grabbed my interest, which is why I invited her to the show, Spaceflight-Associated Brain White Matter Microstructural Changes and Intracranial Fluid Distribution. So not knowing what any of that meant, I did look things up to find out what it meant, and then I asked our good doctor to come on the Space Show. Doctor, welcome to the Space Show, and thank you very much for being here, and how are you today?
Thank you, David. I'm fine. I'm happy to be here.
First of all, since I mentioned brain white matter in the title of the article that caught my attention, give us some introduction. What is meant by brain white matter and some of the other terms that I read about in your abstract and your findings?
Sure. So when we're looking at the human brain using MRI techniques, typically we're focusing on brain gray matter or white matter or cerebrospinal fluid. And the gray matter is the cell bodies of neurons. Also, a lot of the fluid in the brain appears gray. So cerebrospinal fluid on an MR scan will show up gray or very dark gray. So sometimes it's actually hard to tell apart neuron cell bodies from fluid. White matter refers to the pathways that connect different populations of neurons in the brain, or the form the connections of networks, white matter also provides kind of some structural support. So the outer part of the brain, called the cortex, tends to primarily have a lot of the neuronal cell bodies, and then sitting underneath it and supporting it are these white matter pathways and other kinds of support cells.
So according to your research, the white matter changes and fluid is different with astronauts in space flight. So how do you determine this? Are you able to do in-flight research, or is this all done simulated on the ground?
So this is actually, this paper is reporting data that were collected on astronauts before they go to space and then when they get back. So this is more of a pre to post flight experiment. Unfortunately, there's not an MR scanner on the International Space Station. You know, it would be too heavy, too large, and so on to get up there. There are some techniques available, some equipment on the ISS for imaging the brain, but it's not going to give as clear of a picture as if we scan people before they go and when they come back. And I actually have some ongoing experiments with NASA astronauts in which we're scanning the brain before and after flight, and then we are having people do some of our experimental measures while they're on the ISS as well. But this particular paper is more reporting a retrospective analysis, which means that, close to 10 years ago now, NASA started using MRI as a clinical screen on the astronauts. So they would scan them before they went to space and when they get back, kind of as a medical screening, you know, partly to make sure that there weren't any major impending health issues before they go, and also to see whether there were any sort of major medical impacts of spaceflight. So the data that I report in this paper are just from one time point pre-flight and one time point post-flight. And when we're talking about fluid shifts, so the listeners may know that there is a shift in fluids throughout the body when somebody's in microgravity. We don't really think about it when we're on Earth, but basically gravity is pulling all of the fluids in our body towards our feet. And, you know, it's the pumping action of the heart and the one-way valves in a lot of the systems in our body that actually keep fluid up towards the head. And you may have seen photos of astronauts when they first enter microgravity. You can even see this visible, the fluid shift towards the head, as they show this kind of puffy face. You know, the cheeks look a little bit puffed out. And in fact, that's not just happening in the in the skin. It's actually happening throughout the body, including in the brain. So that's one thing that we wanted to quantify in this paper. And then we also wanted to look at the impact on these white matter connections. So this is using kind of a special technique with the MR scanner. It's called diffusion-weighted imaging. So typically, if you went to the hospital for an MR scan because maybe you had a head injury, this is not the kind of scan that you would get. This scan is particularly sensitive to white matter. And then there's a special analysis technique that we do as well to quantify the fluid shifts. So in this paper, we were able to apply these analyses to both the pre-flight and the post-flight images. So we can look at how fluid distribution in the brain changes from pre to post-flight. And then also we're looking at something with the white matter that we would call white matter integrity. It's just a measure of how intact the white matter appears. Some animal studies have shown that this measure can relate to myelination of white matter, which is the insulation that wraps around these white matter connections and helps them to conduct signals faster throughout the brain.
So is the time an astronaut spends in microgravity a variable on what you find? And if you were to actually go beyond low Earth orbit, where the station is, for example, and go to the moon or go to Mars, would being on a different body and with gravity and other issues play a role in all of this, or is none of this makes any difference?
No, those are great questions. I think they're very important questions. So with the fluid in this particular paper, what we report is that there's actually kind of an increase in fluid around the bottom part of the brain and a decrease near the top. And this relates to another finding that my group and another group as well has reported, which is that when people are in microgravity, the brain sits higher within the skull than it does on Earth. Again, if you imagine there's no gravity to kind of hold it down within the skull, and there's this extra fluid within the intracranial cavity. So the brain is, in a sense, floating higher in the skull than it would on Earth. And in this paper, there were a number of, for each astronaut, basically, they were scanned at a different point in time after they had returned to Earth. So some of them were scanned very soon after they returned. Some were scanned up to 3 weeks later. And we account for this in the analyses. Even when we account for it, we still see this effect that at least a few weeks after spaceflight, the brain is sitting higher in the skull than before people go to space. And that's actually probably a good thing, that the brain doesn't just kind of plop back down into place as soon as you enter Earth's gravitational field again, because that could be something, you know, like a traumatic brain injury. So the fluid is cycled out of the skull kind of slowly through cerebrospinal fluid turnover and other mechanisms. And one of the things that we do find in this paper, we are comparing NASA shuttle astronauts. So listeners probably know the space shuttle doesn't fly anymore, but when it did, those crews would spend, you know, just a few weeks or a month in space. And then also in this same sample, we have International Space Station astronauts who typically spend more like 4 to 6 months in microgravity. And in some cases, there were some differences in the fluid redistribution. But it's interesting. It's not that necessarily that there was more fluid redistribution for people who had been up longer, but rather it's different. So for shorter duration flyers, they would have an increase in fluid in one part of the brain, and longer duration flyers would have a decrease in the same region. And David, frankly, it's a little bit difficult to unpack what that means. You know, some of our other measures, we see larger brain changes the longer people are in space. But also, in this particular paper, we find differential effects based on the number of times that someone has been to space. So it's almost like, as well, it's not just the duration, it's also the gravitational transitions that people experience when they go up and come back. It's actually very rare these days that astronauts are naive flyers. You know, you imagine once they do the job well, NASA wants to use them again. So there is some time in between multiple missions, and that's one question I'm really interested in getting at with my current study is how long does it take the brain to return to what it looked like pre-flight? And so in our current experiments, we're actually following up the crew members when they get back to Earth over a period of 6 months after their flight. And so one of the questions we're asking is, does the brain return to pre-flight levels at this period of 6 months?
How do you think it would change if someone was on the moon or Mars or in a flight
right,
to Mars.
Right, with a partial gravity environment.
Uh-huh.
Right. So I would expect that things would be maybe similar, but not quite as extreme, right? So, if you would have partial gravity, our biology has not evolutionarily adapted to these environments, right? So I think it's a really fascinating question. What is the adaptive response of the nervous system and the human biology to these environments? My sense is that we would probably do better in a partial gravity environment than a microgravity environment, but at this point, we don't really have the data to answer that question.
So I do have a caller waiting, but let me ask you a question first.
Sure.
I would imagine if we had the technology and the money and people were willing to put the time into it and someone was willing to pay for the research and help evaluate it and use it, we could research what happens to the human body endlessly for the next 100 years and not come up with all the possible changes and impacts of being in microgravity or space flight. So the question is, does any of this matter? I mean, are there consequences for this fluid shift and the changes in white matter that may impact us if we are ever able to go and, say, live on Mars or something like that? Or is it just nice, good academic and medical information to know?
Right. I think there's two answers to that question. One is, you're asking about does it matter? So we can talk about the operational relevance and health impact, if you will.
Okay.
So some of these, the white matter changes are directly in regions in the brain that process sensory information and control movement. In particular, we see a lot of both gray and white matter changes in the part of the brain that processes sensory information coming from the legs and that controls movement of the legs. So every time that we stand up on Earth, we don't think about it, but these large muscles in our legs are actively contracted so that we don't crumple on the floor due to the effects of gravity. And in a microgravity environment, for example, on the ISS, we don't have to do that. We don't have to use our legs to walk around. You could simply just, use a light touch against the side of the ISS and float all the way to the other side. And interestingly, we see some correlations between how much the white matter changes and what behavior looks like when people return from space. So when people get back from a mission to the International Space Station or even a shuttle flight, they spend a few weeks learning to readapt to moving in Earth's gravitational field. And primarily, they're readapting and they're experiencing basically disturbances to how they process sensory information and how they move. There is a small balance organ in the inner ear called the vestibular system, and it actually works with gravity. So if you tilt your head to the side, then gravity pulls around some fluid in the vestibular system. And in the absence of gravity, if you tilt your head in microgravity, the fluid does not move. And the brain is initially confused by this. This actually can relate to space motion sickness that many crew members experience in their first couple of days during a mission. But once you adapt, then when you come back to Earth, you have to readapt to learn how to deal with these sensory signals again. And so some of these white matter changes are correlated with larger performance disturbances when people come back. Now, what that means for operational relevance is kind of a question. So imagine if we, if we land someone on Mars and they need to quickly escape their vehicle or they need to get into a rover and drive it around. Well, if they're having difficulty coordinating eye and head movements and maintaining their balance, then under some kind of emergency situation, this could be catastrophic. But at the same time, if, you know, people are going on a mission and they're coming back and, you know, there's not a water landing and there's people who can help them to get out of their vehicle and all conditions are ideal, then it may not be that much of an issue. Although, you know, I think we have to ask ourselves what kind of risk do we want to place people into. But I think the second way to answer the question is, you know, you talked about what is the scientific knowledge or medical basic knowledge that you would get from this work. And that, I think, is extremely important. It's a really fascinating question for me as someone who studies how the brain changes when people learn new motor skills. I mean, you might imagine an experiment in which I maybe have somebody learning how to play the piano, and maybe they would practice half an hour or an hour a day, or if they were really dedicated, maybe a few hours a day, and then I'm measuring their performance and their brain scans. Well, you know, at some point they're going to say, that's enough practice, I can't do anymore. But people that are on the International Space Station, they are exposed to this microgravity stimulus 24 hours a day for 6 months. So the central nervous system and the individual's biology is constantly adapting. And again, we have not evolved to deal with this environment. And, you know, if you really wanted to look at that level of neuroplasticity on Earth, it's probably not going to be happening in a healthy brain. It might instead be someone adapting to an injury, such as a stroke or an injury to the limb, or adapting to a disease. So I think there's certainly operational relevance and also great scientific relevance.
But nobody coming back, or I guess in flight that we know about, has been so impaired that a mission has been halted, there's been an emergency, or, you know, they've come back as a vegetable or they turn into a vegetable. So somehow we must endure, or is it going to be different when we get beyond low Earth orbit?
I think in part, you know, getting beyond low Earth orbit can mean a couple of things, right? You know, a mission to Mars, you know, depending on which model you're looking at, could be up to a couple of years. And I think at this point, we maybe don't know enough. So the fact that some of these changes increase when you talk about 1 month versus 6 months of spaceflight, well, then I think the next obvious question is what happens with 1 year, or what happens with 2 years. So you may know about the, you know, the 1 year mission that NASA had, and the twin study, but that's an N of one or two people, right? So, you know, I think we need to have a better understanding of how these things change when you double or triple the amount of time that anyone has spent in space before. Of course, you're absolutely right. No one has come back with a devastating impairment or, you know, with cognitive dementia. But at the same time, I think we would wonder, again, if there were some situation where, you know, if the vestibular system is not working right, you have difficulties with balance, walking, with eye-head coordination, if there were some kind of emergency landing, I don't know how clear it is that people could get themselves out. And, I absolutely don't think that's the case for things we're talking about, like with plans for space tourism, where people might just go for a few hours. In that case, you're really not going to be having these large-scale adaptations and sensory motor changes. But if we're talking about a multi-year mission, then I think it's a big question mark. I think it's a fascinating question, but I think it's an important question to figure out. And then, you know, if there does seem to be a dose response effect, if you will, where you get larger changes the longer you spend in microgravity, then we just need to think about what are the countermeasures. And people are already thinking about this. For example, you know, the lower body negative pressure suit, which helps to bring fluid back down into the lower limbs. People have been studying that for a while and thinking about it for other aspects of the circulatory system, but potentially it could also work, you know, with this extra fluid shift to the brain. We don't know yet, but I think there's a lot of options.
Significant differences with men and women, and I suspect your research will either come in through by doing it and it's on the job, because I don't know how you can simulate it, or maybe there are going to be good simulations to where you can do this research here on Earth. Is there a men versus woman difference, and is it on the job training and research for the most part?
So the sex difference is an interesting question. Right now the samples are so small that, David, it's really, I think, hard to answer that question. It's something that NASA is paying a lot more attention to, and trying to get experiments that, you know, match the population of the crew. But, you know, in this particular paper, certainly there were more men than women. And, you know, what we try to do is covary for males and females. I don't know that we have a large enough sample to really talk about differences at this time. And then you were asking about how to do the work and on-the-job training. So there are a couple of very interesting analog environments that NASA likes to use and that we've worked with. One is long-duration bed rest. So they take human subjects and put them on bed rest with the head tilted below the feet, typically by about 6 degrees. And these subjects stay in bed for a month or 2 months. They do not get up. They use a bedpan. They take a supine shower. And, of course, they're paid quite a bit for this.
Are they sedated?
No. Can you imagine how awful you would feel after
that
much time without moving?
Yeah.
But it actually does a reasonable job of simulating a couple of aspects of the microgravity environment, one of which is the fluid shift towards the head. Another is the unloading of the body, and changes in how the brain integrates different sources of sensory information. We actually have a study that we're kicking off at the end of the month where people will be on long-duration bed rest, but they also will be spun in a human centrifuge for half an hour a day as a way of simulating artificial gravity. And they will be lying on their back with their feet pointed, in such a direction that they are receiving a 1G force along the long axis of the body towards the feet. And so I think it'll be really interesting to look at, does that, is it enough to help with these fluid shifts? Is it enough in terms of providing sensory inputs and sensory stimulation so that we either reduce or eliminate these fluid shifts and white matter changes? And, you know, artificial gravity is not a realistic option right now for example, for the space station or for other space vehicles. But having a better understanding of what works and what doesn't, I think, will be important.
Let's hope that your caller did not get frustrated at me. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. I apologize for the long delay, and I hope you're still there. Who are you, and where are you, please?
Hi, David. No problem. This is John in Fremont, California.
Hi. Welcome back to the show. Thank you very much for your patience.
Oh, no problem. I've been enjoying the discussion, and in fact, some of my questions were answered while I was waiting. But my first question was, did your studies look at cognitive abilities as opposed to sensory and mobility input? And then I know some of these white matter changes, the impact is reversible, but what about cognitive, and is there a danger that you know, people may never recover. I'll take my answer off the air.
Wait a minute, John. Oh. Don't take it off the air. I want to get back to you with something, okay?
Okay.
Go ahead,
sure.
Rachel. Uh-huh.
Yeah, thanks, John. Those are terrific questions. So the data that I have published so far are they're basically the scans came from NASA's medical monitoring program. And so part of that program does include balance testing and other measures of mobility. So in the papers that we have published so far, I only have the sensory motor measures. But in our ongoing work, we do have a lot of cognitive measures as well as sensory motor measures. So these are our measures of short-term memory or what we call working memory, where you hold information in mind and manipulate it over a period of a few seconds. We're also looking at cognitive processing speed, the ability to do mental rotation tasks, because that, you know, would impact things like using a robotic arm and so on. And this data collection is ongoing, so I don't want to say too much about it, but we are hopefully finishing up with that data collection over the next couple of years. And the preliminary results do suggest that there's some impact on processing speed, or that there's a small amount of slowing, cognitive slowing. It's relatively minor, though. I know there are other groups as well looking at cognitive changes with spaceflight, and I think they report similar things. It's interesting that these studies that have quantitatively measured cognition are only finding small changes, because there have been several anecdotal reports of crew members reporting what they call space fog, where they just feel a little bit disconnected and they slow down the tasks that they're doing in an effort to maintain accuracy. So I don't know, maybe we just haven't developed the right cognitive tests yet. I'm not sure. The question about whether any of these things might be permanent is also very interesting. You know, of course, if we see brain changes and performance changes in one direction, you know, you would expect that there's at least the capacity for them to change back in the other direction and at least show some return towards where people were pre-flight. Our ongoing experiments, we are following people out to a period of 6 months after they return. And these sensory motor changes that we know occur do resolve pretty much completely by a period of up to maybe 3 or 4 weeks post-flight. Now, the question is whether that means the brain is controlling them in the same way. We don't know. It may be that the behavior is normalized, but the brain is relying on different networks to perform those behaviors. So this is still an ongoing question. I think it's a very interesting question, but we don't know the answer yet. And one thing that I think is also interesting, these white matter changes that we saw with spaceflight are essentially in the same direction that you would expect to see with healthy aging. They're just occurring at a faster pace than what you might expect with aging while people are in microgravity. So, you know, I think it remains to be seen just exactly how they recover and what the time course of recovery is.
Rachel, do you have any awareness of, I'm not interested in names or anything like that,
sure,
of any astronauts having a stroke or developing dementia at somewhat of an early age rather than, you know, normal aging?
I'm not aware of anything. The caveat I would give is that, you know, the missions, longer missions to the International Space Station that are ranging more like 4 to 6 months, you know, a lot of the people who have been on those missions haven't really had the chance to experience extensive aging yet. If you see what I'm saying, we've just started doing that in the relatively recent past. So I'm not aware of any cases like that, but at the same time, you know, the older retired astronauts are people who would have been on much shorter, you know, lunar missions or orbiting missions or space shuttle missions.
What is the age that you or your peers consider the start of normal aging?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think this is a moving target in terms of a definition. So a lot of the work research on cognitive and brain aging, we tend to start testing people that are around 65 to 70 years old and go up to people that are 85 to 90. Of course, we are aging much more healthily than we have in the past. But I do have a paper that is under review right now where I found the results to be a little bit depressing. We were finding changes in sensory and motor function for people starting in their late 30s. So we know the visual system as well actually peaks for people in their 20s and then starts to decline. Of course, declines at that age are not noticeable to the individual, but they are measurable with precise instruments. So, you know, the question of when aging starts is a moving target.
Will you let me know when that paper is out there? I'd like to follow up on that.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I'd be happy to.
Now, can you do aging studies on animals? Is there any correlation to humans, like dogs or chimps or anything like that?
Sure. There are quite a few studies on non-human animals, including on rodents. So rodents, there are actually MR scanners with head coils that work on rodents. And so you can do a lot of these same neuroimaging measures in the non-human animal model. And then you can also add much more invasive measures on top of that and actually look at cell counts and myelination and you know, much more precise understanding of the mechanisms.
Do they get dementia and have strokes like humans?
Do rodents?
No, I'm thinking of bigger animals like chimps or dogs or something like that.
Boy, I don't know about dementia. From what I know about stroke research in non-human animal models, they are induced strokes. So you would actually go in and occlude the blood vessel for a period of time.
Yeah, you'd cause it. Okay.
Yep.
John, before you go, I know that you started a blog, and I know it doesn't have anything to do with this show, but listeners, John is a frequent caller. If you like his calls, if you like his recommendations for guests and comments on open lines, you may like participating and paying attention to his new blog. John, tell him how to find it real quick.
SpaceDevelopmentProgress.com.
SpaceDevelopmentProgress.com.
Sorry. Space Settlement Progress.
Okay. If you want to post a link to it on the blog for this show, since I brought it up, do so, okay?
Okay.
Thank you for your call, John.
Yep.
Okay. Listeners, we have freed the line. If you would like to call in and talk to our guest today, it is 1-866-687-7223. Is there anything out there that would give you concern about human spaceflight to Mars or space settlement on the moon? And by settlement, I don't mean a highly trained astronaut base on the moon or Mars, but just normal folks going there, like people in the settlement industry and stuff talk about. Is there anything that your research shows that we need to be cautionary about this, or can we just proceed and learn as we go?
Well, I think that's a tough question. You know, as someone who studies the brain, looks at the brain a lot, thinks about the brain, when I see these kinds of changes, you know, I think it's not something that I would be significantly concerned and worried about. But the issue is that I hesitate to extrapolate to what happens in the longer term, especially if, you know, if someone were to stay there and not come back to Earth's gravitational environment or not have access to a countermeasure or artificial gravity, just because we don't know how these things will continue to expand. It's not clear, for example, if you would expect, you know, if you're there for 1 year, would you expect two times the change that you saw with 6 months? Who knows? Maybe you would expect that, or maybe things would settle off after 6 months and stop changing altogether, in which case, you know, that would be a positive thing. Or there may even be some accelerating effect if the system is compensating for a while and then no longer can do so. So I think that's kind of the question mark.
Terry is in Denver with an email, and we have another caller on hold wanting you. And Terry says, many in the space settlement area look forward to families on Mars, maybe even on the moon. Is there any clue? Can you infer anything about babies, children, people at a much younger age, and these types of white matter and other brain changes? What would happen there? I would imagine their brains are very, very different than adults going to the International Space Station.
Sure. Again, this, you know, would be a speculative answer, but brains of infants and children are much more adaptive than adult brains. They're just going through massive changes in terms of birth of new neurons and growth of connections between existing neurons and myelination of these white matter pathways so that they can conduct signals faster. These things do happen in the adult brain as well, but just absolutely nowhere near to the same extent as in children. And so, I mean, that could mean that actually that they're maybe more adaptive. They might adapt better and faster, and the brain may come up with different pathways and routes for dealing with these things. And I guess maybe just one more comment about your question, David, on do I see anything concerning. You know, I guess my sense is if people are adventurers, I mean, they're going to sit in a capsule that's on top of a rocket, you know, just loaded with jet fuel, and they're going to blast themselves to a new planet and explore. Of course they know there are risks, right? And,
right.
It's sort of the adventurous spirit of mankind. So, I think everyone has a different tolerance for risk.
Let's see who your next caller is. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you and where are you, please? Thank you for calling.
This is Marshall.
Hi there.
I have been reading a lot on intelligence lately. The Flynn effect, where over generations we're actually getting smarter, et cetera, et cetera. And one of the things that you kind of imply but don't specifically say is there a possibility that somebody goes off into space and literally comes back stupid?
Again, that is not what we see happening right now. So I would say even with very sensitive cognitive assessments, we are seeing minor changes. I don't see that happening. But it's speculation. Again, we don't know if someone goes for 3 years and then comes back. There's nothing no data I have that would speak to that at this point. And I think the concern about even seeing minor cognitive changes, is that the people that we are measuring right now are extremely high functioning, intensively trained individuals who have a very demanding job. And so I think even small changes could be posing an operational risk to some extent. And I think being aware of the changes and thinking about, can you adapt either mission demands or, can you implement countermeasures of some sort? Just how are we going to deal with this? But I don't see that anyone is coming back, with a dramatic IQ drop or inability to do their job or nothing of that magnitude.
Marshall, you've been on the farm in Oklahoma too long.
Well, if you sit on a tractor plowing all day, it does impact your brain. Anyway, the next part, you had kind of implied that you're doing certain, I think you called it a three-dimensional manipulation tests and so on like that, which is really a part of an IQ test.
Yes.
Is there specific areas that are looked at and specific areas that probably need research?
That's a great question, and yes, very good point. So portions of IQ tests do test spatial cognition or this mental rotation, and this other metric that I talked about called working memory, which is really a short-term memory measure, tends to be correlated with IQ. And processing speed as well. I think that I and others that are working in this area tried to pick cognitive constructs that underlie a lot of human behaviors that you could imagine would be relevant for a space mission. So short-term memory, attention, focus, mental manipulation of images or objects. As far as areas that are not being looked at, I mean, I think there are some really interesting new studies that are just kicking off. So people I know who are looking at the part of the brain that processes spatial navigation. A lot of times we use visual landmarks to navigate our environment, and you know, those landmarks are very different. The sense of up and down in the absence of gravity is dramatically changed. I and others as well are looking at sensory motor behaviors, coordination, balance, how you learn new motor skills. So I think a lot of it has been covered or is being covered, but of course we could always do more.
Yes. One of the things I kind of notice about myself and other people is there are some people, like you said, are very visually oriented, and
mm-hmm.
then there's some people that, you know, they reach out and touch things, and they're spatially oriented in how they move around. Now, out on the farms, of course, you have visual, which like, oh, I've got to go to that tree that's a straight line versus, you know, you want to do it straight so it's easy to harvest. But there are times that you have to go around stuff. Is there any kind of work in that type of area?
So I think some of this spatial navigation work may address that. You know, looking at how you navigate and go around objects, or, you know, if you were in a particular location and you were turned around, you know, what are the landmarks that you would use? When do you decide to go around an object versus over or under? Those kinds of questions. So I don't so much know people looking at, you know, some of this navigation, it's called sort of egocentric versus allocentric. So do you represent landmarks in space relative to your body, or do you represent landmarks in space relative to more cardinal coordinates, you know, up, down, left, right, as
mm-hmm.
opposed to relative to my body midline or on this or that side of my body? That's definitely part of the human navigation system. I'm just not sure if that's being done in the experiments that I talked about, but there are definitely individual differences in how people navigate along those dimensions.
Well, I think I've had enough fun for today.
Okay.
Enjoy your conversation.
Thank you, Marshall.
Oh, thank you for the call.
Listeners, the line is available, and there is still time if you want to call us, 1-866-687-7223. And Connie is in Seattle, and she says, you have not yet mentioned, but maybe there's no impact. I'm curious about the role of nutrition and the psychological status of a particular crew member and how that might affect the brain, along with the other physical characteristics of spaceflight, that you've been talking to, we do know that psychological issues certainly affect people's brain and how they're thinking and how they work and function here on Earth. I would imagine psychological issues in space are also really key and probably play a role, plus nutrition. Do you have a way to analyze that as part of your analysis?
So, Connie, these are great questions. So you're talking about psychological state and nutrition. As far as psychological state, that's not particularly my area of expertise, but I know there are many groups that are working on this, and they do excellent work, research on team dynamics for small teams working together in isolated environments. So part of this research is done directly with astronauts, and part of it is done with teams working in other places. For example, people that are wintering over at Arctic research field stations and are not able to leave those environments for long stretches of time. So how interpersonal dynamics play out, and because that's not really my expertise, I'm not going to say too much about it, but just to make you aware that that work is certainly being done, and there's some excellent work being done, so I encourage you to take a look at it. In terms of nutrition, that also is a very important question. There are a couple of key areas where nutrition could be playing a big role, and one topic that we have not really touched on yet today, but that's this spaceflight-associated neuroocular syndrome. And this refers to a portion of the crew members. It's roughly maybe 1 in 5, 1 in 4 or so are coming back from space with structural changes to the eye and the optic nerve. And it's not clear yet what the cause of this is. It could be linked to these fluid shifts that I've been talking about. So there could be increased fluid pressure behind the eye that is resulting in this. There is also a researcher at NASA, Dr. Scott Smith, who works on this topic kind of extensively, and he has identified a particular metabolic pathway that seems to be involved. And in fact, it seems like the vitamin B folate status seems to be associated with this ocular syndrome. And so his work is actually suggesting that this should be potentially measured before people go to space, and that you could design experiments to look at whether supplementation might actually play a role in that process. There are other ways in which good nutrition and exercise as well impact brain health in terms of brain blood flow and perfusion and so on, that I think are not being looked at closely enough. I think these are important questions as well. For example, to look at questions like how might the amount of exercise that a given crew member engages in relate to any of these brain changes that we see.
Could better nutrition, for example, and mental health offset some of the other changes that you're seeing? Are they pronounced enough or strong enough to where they could be mitigation strategies?
Boy, I don't know. I think that's a tough question. I know that there is a lot of research being done on kind of environmental enrichment for spaceflight. And so this is thinking about if you were to send a crew to Mars, the amount of time the travel might take, and the fact that there is no cupola like there is on the ISS, there are no windows. How are you going to keep people in a positive frame of mind, especially since communications, as the vehicle gets further away, communications with people on the ground will be delayed, maybe even by up to, 10 to 15 minutes. So imagine how hard it would be to carry on a conversation with loved ones and colleagues. So, that may become an issue. I'm not sure how much that is an issue right now. Certainly, I believe the crew members, our current astronauts, are under pressure. They have a lot of their hours of the day are heavily scheduled. They're doing very important and sometimes very risky behaviors while they are in space. They're not getting their usual amount of sleep, where they are being asked to sleep at odd hours relative to their biological circadian rhythms. But every lecture that I have seen and heard former crew members talking about their experiences, they also spend a lot of time talking about the euphoria of seeing the Earth as a whole and being able to have a new perspective on their planet and, you know, the amazing views from the cupola on the ISS. So I'm not sure that mental health, I mean, of course, you miss your family and your friends and colleagues and loved ones, but I think there's maybe enough of a beneficial trade-off. I could be wrong, but my general sense is that there are not any kind of severe mental health problems, at least with the current operational plans. And again, that may change dramatically if someone is more like in a tin can without windows traveling to Mars.
You have another blog email from John, who called a little while ago, and he says, you mentioned that artificial gravity is not yet possible on space missions. I believe this is an engineering problem that is solvable, given the risk to crew operational capabilities posed by the impact of white matter changes. Shouldn't research on AG be accelerated?
Yeah, John, that's another terrific question. You may know that artificial gravity as a potential countermeasure has come in and out of favor over the decades. You know, there were a lot of experiments, 1950s and 60s, with human centrifugation as you know, potential artificial gravity, and just to understand human biological responses to high G-force levels as well, not just 1G, but higher. A lot of this work was done in 1950s and 60s, and it is definitely an engineering problem. The upmass, I think, would be the major problem at this time point. It would have to be something very heavy, very expensive. But there are this study that I described that we're kicking off at the end of the month with the human centrifugation coupled with bed rest. There are quite a few both NASA-funded and ESA-funded, European Space Agency-funded experiments that will be taking place with the same subjects at the same time. This study will be carried out at the German Aerospace Institute in Cologne, Germany. So I'm very excited. There's going to be a lot of human biology and human physiology that will come out of these experiments. The experiments will wrap up at the end of 2019. So, you know, maybe a year from now, we'll start hearing about some of the results. And I agree, it's an important and interesting question, and I'm excited to see what comes out of these new studies.
Do you have any studies or experiments in this program?
I do, actually. We'll be looking at brain changes, including the fluid shifts in white matter, as well as some gray matter measures. We'll be looking at sensory motor and cognitive changes as well.
So do you go to Germany, or is all of this carried out by other people?
I actually was just there with one of my postdoctoral fellows a couple of weeks ago, getting everything set up. We are also doing some cognitive testing while people are in the centrifuge, so trying to get a handle on how the artificial gravity might impact cognitive and perceptual performance as well. And then there will be someone over there who will be collecting my data and sending it back to me.
How do you get someone that can tolerate this kind of physical restriction and positions for you know, 6 weeks or 2 months or something without being sedated? Or do you secretly drug their food or something?
So it's, you know, there have been a range of individuals who have participated in these bed rest experiments. So people who do seasonal work, people who are students, people who are fascinated by spaceflight and want to learn more and, you know, maybe write a book or a screenplay, those tend to be a lot of the participants. And, again, they are paid reasonably well. The centrifugation piece, I think, adds a new dimension to this one. I don't think I would want to do it. They will be spinning at a constant velocity of around 29 or 30 revolutions per minute, depending on their body size, so that they do get 1G of force applied along the body from the head towards the feet. But what they tell me at this facility is they screen people out of the study by putting them into the centrifuge and seeing who gets motion sick and who doesn't. And if you can keep your head extremely still, many of the people report they don't even feel like they're moving. So that's kind of fascinating to me. I'm not a roller coaster person, so I don't think I would tolerate it very well.
For your work at the university, do you find that it attracts a lot of students, undergraduates and graduates, or is it available to undergraduates? I'm curious to the student interest in this type of spaceflight research.
Yes, so I have both undergraduates, graduate students, and postdoctoral fellows in my lab, and I find certainly students are attracted to this, and I actually try to leverage that for outreach that we do with schools and other populations, to try and pull kids into science and get them interested at a young age and let them know that there's a huge range of topics that they can address with science.
Fascinating work. Is there anything that we should have talked about in our brief hour than what we've covered, or that we've omitted or should have talked about? Is there something else that you think we should know about? I mean, there's probably a lot that we probably haven't even touched the topic, but
I think we went through a lot of the things on the topic. I would just say that I think there's a lot of fascinating ongoing work by lots of different research groups in this area. So I would say stay tuned over the next couple of years, and I'm happy to come back and talk about future work or to point you towards other people that I think would be a good fit.
Great, and I got an 11th hour email, if you're willing to stay
sure.
for an extra minute.
Sure.
So this is Ken, is in Tucson, and he says, I have a question I'm dying to ask you. I'm not sure it's related to your space work, but I have, over the years, gone to various doctors who insist that I need to do kinesiology and muscle testing. David said that you're in the kinesiology department. Is there any real science to what some kinds of doctors do with muscle testing and then saying you need this vitamin or that food or this vitamin, or is this nonsense?
Oh, boy. Okay, that's kind of a loaded question without knowing all the circumstances. But I would say particularly movement disorders clinics do a lot of muscle testing, not just brain testing, but muscle as well. And, you know, looking at nerve conduction in the muscles can be indicative of quite a range of real conditions. In terms of combating those things with nutrition, I think we take nutrition and vitamins for granted in a lot of ways, and that there are a lot of food products that can help us to stay healthy. But if it's something like a disease condition, I would make sure that you are talking to your physician about what your options are.
So I don't know, Ken, but in my eternal quest for losing weight, which has truly been
we
eternal,
all have, right?
I have been to, I won't say what kind of doctors, because I don't want to insinuate one thing or another, that have said, the key is muscle testing, so put your arm out and hold this, or do that, and, you need more zinc, so this is what you need to do, or you need more mercury, or you're getting too much of this, or too much of that. I have a feeling that that's kind of what Ken is talking about. So none of this ever worked for me, and I quit seeing all of those people. But I think that's what he's talking about. So
I see. Okay.
So it's sort of the popularization of kinesiology and holding something in your arm straight out. And if your arm is weak, it means you need more of this or, you know, something.
I see.
Okay.
Yeah, actually, I'm not familiar with that kind of testing. So sorry, then I can't comment on it.
Okay, so, and I doubt it has anything to do with spaceflight, but thank you anyway, Ken. Well, I hope we can bring you back for more space show programs on these topics. They're fascinating, and we could probably do a 3-day marathon show, and we wouldn't even touch all of what's going on in the field. So hopefully you'll be willing to come back and talk more to us, and I'll follow. Do you have a newsletter or something you publish that people can follow on your work?
I don't. As far as research articles, I would say you can follow people on something called ResearchGate, all one word, G-A-T-E. So if you have a favorite scientist, when their paper comes out, you can get an alert. Definitely I would be happy to come back sometime. This was a lot of fun.
Thank you very much. We certainly appreciate your being here, and I'll get this archived either tonight or early in the morning and send it to you, and we look forward to talking to you again on the Space Show.
Thank you.
And listeners, that's it for today. Everybody have a great rest of the weekend. We're back Tuesday with Ed Wright, and so keep it safe for the weekend, and above all, keep looking up. Goodbye from Rachel David and the Space Show.